Van Helf got reel 16.
So I got used to this routine of rowing on the Vltava every morning from about between 9 and 10 o'clock till about 12 o'clock. Because that sharpened my appetite. It was also developing my muscles a little bit. And altogether, I really was enjoying the calmness, the tranquility of being on the water, and just the relaxation that for the first time in many years that I was enjoying. I finished at around 12 and now started, I went from kitchen to kitchen because there were quite a number of kitchens all over Prague. Prague was a large place, the capital of Czechoslovakia. And I finished one meal and then I went to another one. It wasn't that I could have eaten as much as possible in one place. But they had different food in different places. So from about 12 o'clock till 4 o'clock, this is what I was doing for about 2 weeks, just eating lunches. And I simply found that it was never enough. My appetite was really enormous, and it was growing. The more I was eating, the more I wanted to eat, and I was really enjoying it.
Was your system able to cope with this?
Well, apparently,
stories of how a lot of people died.
Yes, but apparently I was able to cope with it because when I think back about it, it was because I did not. By the time I came to Prague, it was already about 10 days after my liberation, and when I was liberated, I also did not eat. I did not eat all that much. I was eating more and more, in a way, subconsciously, or I don't think it was conscious, because I really did not understand the meaning of diet and the amount of what one consumes, the importance of it or unimportance of it, like I understand it today. But I must have had a sort of sixth sense, or rather my gastronomic condition was such that I knew when to stop. And I think I'm very lucky in this respect, because I can say the same thing for I've never been drunk in my life, but not because I didn't want to get drunk. Simply because once I have consumed a certain amount of alcohol, the law of diminishing utility has set in very early, and I simply cannot drink any more. Because if I do, I feel sick, and I'm not enjoying it. Now, it's exactly the same with food. Whilst I enjoy a healthy appetite, and at that time especially, I enjoyed gargantuan appetite. But I also, had the ability of knowing where to stop, because I simply, beyond that, I felt sick. So I didn't eat myself until I was sick. So
did you witness any instance where people died because they ate too much?
I didn't exactly witness it, but I know of a number of people who have, when they were liberated, they ate more than their stomach could cope with. They took sick and some of them died. Many of them died.
Was there much advice that went round the camp amongst inmates or from liberators concerning how much to eat? And
oh, good heavens, no. I mean, this was... everything was so haphazard. Everything was in such a state of disorder. It was just unbelievable. It wasn't like suddenly people came along and said, now look, we're going to take care of you, we're going to take you away, and this came afterwards. But at that stage, it was all haphazard. I mean, the Russians were very good in so far that they gave us so-called laissez-faire, do what you want. they left us alone. But guidance, there was no guidance from the Russians, and certainly no guidance from the inmates, because everybody was for himself. We were still in that state where self-preservation was still the most important thing. So, and the result was that a lot of people died. I mean, you didn't know. I mean, we didn't look at each other and say, look, don't eat too much or whatever. We didn't know.
Was there any check kept on who was leaving the camp? Where you were going?
Or? No. No. Later on, yes. But at the beginning, there was no check at all. It was all very, very haphazard.
What was the Russians' reaction to you when they saw you?
Well, when the Russians, by the time they came to us, they have already witnessed many, many other atrocities and have met up with many camp inmates. And so we were no novelty to them. And also, I must understand, as far as the Russians are concerned, that the Russians, that the Germans were very cruel with the Russians. They killed whole villages, and the Russians were used to cruelty. They knew what cruelty meant. So, and in a way, they responded with cruelty as well. I mean, when they went into German places and so on, their behavior, in some respects, was also a lot to be desired, also understandable as it may have been. So their reaction to us was, well, again, another lot, and, well, help them as much as you can, and that's it. I must tell you that there were quite a lot of Jewish soldiers in the Russian army, and many of them were very high ranking and officers. And they came in, they met us, and they were very sympathetic. But so were the Russians, as much as they could be. But as far as they were concerned, they did their job. We were liberated, and the rest was up to us. Of course, they set up special place. They set up a special provision, place for provisions, where they could give us out food, they gave us clothing, and only it's like rations, certain amount of a pair of trousers, a jacket, underwear, and so on. And this we got very early. But when we got into Prague, again, there were similar places like this. So again, we went to these places, and slowly we were accumulating a lot of, now we would call it rubbish, but to us, this was the only possession that we would get. I mean, I would find myself, I would have two or three pairs of trousers. I would have two or three jackets. I would have half a dozen shirts. I mean, this was such luxury for the first time in so many years to acquire a wardrobe. It was marvelous. And okay, so from about, so to come back to what I was saying about my routine of life was, rowing on the Vltava till 12 o'clock, from 12 till 4 o'clock eating lunch, as much as I could possibly stuff myself with, and then from 4 o'clock onwards, there was the third thing, was cinema. So in a way, you could see I was satisfying three things. I was satisfying my muscles, I was satisfying my stomach, and then the third thing, I was satisfying my mind. And that was going from cinema to cinema until the cinema was finished, the evening at 11 o'clock. And of course there were about three or four circuses, so we went to the circus as well, and sometimes we went a few times to the circus. And it was a very enjoyable routine. I was making more friends, and I was going on the trams from place to place, and I just loved walking in Prague. Prague is such a beautiful place, and Prague was not was completely untouched. Everything was left exactly as it was, and the buildings, most buildings have got a history on them. Beautiful paintings, mosaics, and mementos of the past, which And it was quite exciting to walk around and looking at it. Of course, there were museums, there were all kinds of things that I was running around looking for. So we also went to, saw for the first time, a museum that is still there now, that the Germans actually prepared this, because the Germans planned the complete destruction of the Jews. But they also thought that once the Jews are destroyed, that they must leave some kind of mementos that they ever existed. So they collected from all over Europe specific items of Jewish interest. And it was very interesting to see how they did it and the kind of things that they presented them. It's still there now. But the thing that really upset me and horrified me was when I saw a lampshade made from human skin, from human skins, when they said it was made from Jewish skins. And I saw soap, a piece of soap made from human fat. And for the first time, I realized something that I did not understand about 2.5 years earlier, when I used to work in the glass factory, and there were transports passing by being sent to the guest chambers. And the Poles used to shout, "More of them being sent for soap." And I really thought this was a kind of a joke. When they said this, because I could not comprehend the idea that that one can make soap out of humans. And to the Poles, this was a joke, which they kept on repeating whenever a transport used to pass by. And the transport that used to go by, this glass factory was very, very near the factory, only about a few yards away. I was recently in Poland about 6-7 weeks ago, and I went for the first time since 1943. I went to the glass factory where I worked there. I took with me my wife and my two of my sons. And when I walked in there, I saw the railway station, the railway lines. And I especially called my wife to show it. I said, "Look, you know, I want you to witness this. I've told you before," I said, "about the fact that the railway line was very near the glass factory, and that we witnessed dozens of transports of Jews being sent to the what was to the guest chambers, but we weren't aware of it." And the Poles always crying out that they're being sent for soap. "I want you to see it, how near it is." And it was no more than about 10 yards. Almost, just, you'll look out in the garden here, where this tree is here, there with the red leaf. That's how near the railway line was. And so we could see it, and so we were witnesses to everything. And to the Poles, it was a joke. And for the first time, when I came to this museum, I realized that it was no joke, that it actually was translated into reality.
Did it say where this piece of soap or lampshade had come from?
No, no, they didn't say that. Just a piece of soap made from humans, Jewish, from the Jews. It's still there. I mean, it's there for everybody to see today. I mean, when one goes to Prague, if ever you do go to Prague, you must go and see that museum. It's a very interesting museum. Anyway, it was a very, very sad because slowly, as I was in Prague, day by day, we were discovering the real truth of what has happened. Up to now, we were thinking maybe it was just talk about it. We just did not want to accept the reality. But now, as the truth was coming out, papers were writing about it. So whilst I was enjoying my stay in Prague, there was the other side. When I was going back and lying down at night, I was lying on the pillow, and I kept on thinking, what's been happening? What's happened? What happened to all my family? Were they all sent to the guest chambers and so on? And after about 2 weeks, I decided that it's time that I make my way back to Poland, to my hometown, and to see who is there, whether there's somebody who is alive, because I still didn't know whether my sister was alive. I knew about the fate of my mother and my youngest sister. I heard about the fate of my father, but I had other family. I had aunts, I had uncles, and I didn't know exactly what happened to them. So I was told, "You learn things, people, because there was such a." Tremendous movement going backwards and forwards, and Prague being the sort of the center there, that I learned how to make my way, how to go back to Poland. So I got on the train with thousands of people. The trains were just full of refugees. And we went to so much so that there was not enough room inside the train. So many people were on top of the train. So we were traveling on top of the train, and every time we went under in a tunnel, we had to put our heads down in case we would be thrown off. And it happened. Some didn't put their heads down quick enough, and they were thrown off and killed. By the time I got onto the train, there was not much room, and I was really traveling on top. I didn't mind; it was really quite exciting, and it was all very exciting. It was just exciting to be alive, because here we were told about so many people that so many people were being have not survived. This one was killed, and that one was killed, and so on and so on. And just the sheer knowledge that somehow I was alive, it was very exhilarating. I mean, however sad it was to hear that so many people were killed, the fact that I was alive was something...
Did you feel any sense of guilt? A lot of people have said that because so few survived compared to how many died, some of the survivors have felt a sense of guilt about this.
Well, not at that stage. Not at that stage. I don't know how other people felt, but at that stage, the realization that one was alive, that one was breathing in fresh air, that I was on a train, and that when I was lying on top of the train, and I was looking up on the sky, and I couldn't get over the thought that I'm alive. I mean, it was just like a real miracle. I couldn't just believe it. So I don't think, to be truthful to myself, I don't think there was a case here that I was feeling guilty. There was no time for me to think like this because I was still finding out things. I was still learning. I did not know the extent of what was going on. I didn't know the extent of the devastation. When we got near the Polish border, the railway line was disrupted. So we had to get off and we had to walk across. So I think we walked for about a couple of miles. And we got to the Polish border. When we came to the Polish border, I must say, our reception was not a very pleasant one. We had no problems really getting through. I had a pass. It said quite clearly that I was where I was born, where I was liberated, and that was they looked at it, and but there was no sort of warmth, and it was really I was struck by the difference between the reception that I had in Czechoslovakia and the reception now in Poland. I was really very apprehensive altogether about my return because, first of all, I didn't know what to expect, and I was a little bit also worried about what the reception I will be getting when I get to Poland. And I must say, it didn't make me too happy when I suddenly was faced with the Polish customs officers.
Was anything said, or was it just a
well, atmosphere? There was nothing really said, but I mean, it was just like, there is another one here, you know. Yes, where are you going? What are you going to do? You know, sort of. It was very unfriendly. There was no reason for it, because as soon as I opened my mouth, they should have known only too well who I was. But it was written on our faces that we were concentration camp inmates. There were many Poles who were either deported to Germany or who voluntarily went to work in Germany. And of course, many of them are returning now, but none of them really had the same experiences that we had, because they were not in a concentration camp. The majority of Poles were working as, like so many other Europeans, were working in German factories, and they were living somewhere in some digs. So they had their hair, they didn't look exactly like they were fattened up or something. They were, but they looked normal. But most of the Jews who were returning, they looked very, very abnormal because they still have not recovered. Their faces were still emaciated. So the Poles knew right away who was a Pole and who was a Jew, who of those who returned. And when they looked at us, they thought, "Well, like, you're alive." You know, they didn't manage to kill you off. They said it to many people. I mean, they didn't say it to me, but I know many friends who came back when the reaction was, "What? You're alive?" Anyway, I made my way to my hometown. I had to change the train a few times, and when I got there, on the way, I had to stop in one place. Where somebody stopped me and he asked me what camp I came from, and I told him, and he said, "Did you know somebody? Where are you going to?" I told him where I was going to. I was going to my hometown, to Piotrków, and he said, "Do you happen to know was there in this camp a man called Schatz?" And I said to him, "Yes, yes, the man, he was with me, and what's more, I know that he's alive because I saw him after the liberation." And he says, "Really, you must come with me because his wife and his daughter I'm living together with them. And his daughter actually was a friend of mine. She was about a year older than I, but we were quite friendly as children. And she and her mother were sent to another camp from our hometown. And from that camp, she was sent to this town in Częstochowa, where she was liberated. So when he told me about them, so he said, oh, you must come over to us. And you must tell them that the father, the husband is alive. So he took me there to them, and I told them the good news. Well, I don't think this man really was very happy about the good news, because I have a feeling that I think he lived already with them. But he was the very fact that he was looking out for a husband, I mean, maybe he wanted to hear that he didn't make it. I don't know. But anyway, this is just one of those things, because these things did happen in those days. I mean, people, families were just destroyed, and then they got together, and then they found that somebody, after all, was alive, and it was very difficult to decide what to do, to go back to your own husband or to the new man that one teamed up with. But he seemed to be a very nice person, and the very fact that he invited me, the very fact that he wanted me to tell them that he's alive, meant that the man was a very decent man. And so, of course, they were absolutely delighted to see me, and that I'm alive. And I told them about the husband, about the husband. And I stayed there overnight. There was another girl actually staying with them as well, who was only recently liberated, also from my hometown. And the following morning, the two of us traveled back to my hometown. Incidentally, one of the one that she lives in Israel, unfortunately, she's very ill. She has she suffers from atherosclerosis. There you are. It's she went to Israel afterwards, and she got married, and she's got a very nice family.
This is the girl you were traveling. Back
no, that is, that is the girl whose father I
had known.
Whose father was liberated together with me in the camp. Now we got back, and I went. There was a place in my hometown right away where it was an office where people who were returning were registering. So I went there and I registered, and everybody who registered got a certain sum of money, which was provided by a Jewish organization called The Joint. It was one of the largest Jewish charity organizations in the world. And they provided a certain sum, wasn't much, but whatever it was very helpful. And I was told there in that office that there is an aunt of mine who survived, and she's town, and there's another aunt and her husband who have also survived, and they're here. So I really felt that I didn't come back to a void, to an emptiness, and it really I made my way to my aunt, and of course she was absolutely over the moon when she saw me, and she said to me, "Look, I don't know what plans you have, but you stay with me, and be with me, and whatever I'll do, you come be with me," which was very encouraging, and it made me feel very, very good, I must say.